It's Wednesday, the 2nd of April, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, trying to make sense of some of the construction industry news from the past fortnight. And I think you've got a correction to start us off with, Phil. We obviously got something wrong last week, or last fortnight.
Thank you to Nigel Roper, who wrote in saying, I think there's confusion. No surprise there.
That's what I was going to say. David.
That's our usual state. We were talking about LOLA, the lifting regulations, uses of trains and so on, the connection that the government are reviewing, simplifying the LOLA regs, and we were a bit bamboozled how this would happen. And I think I mentioned that the need for appointed persons and lift plans was all part of LOLA. And Nigel has written in to say, nope, got that one wrong. That's BS7121, which I find that I'm still a little bit confused by that, because British standards are just standards. They're not rules, as I understand it. And LOLA are rules. And as I understand it, lift plans and appointed persons are rules. But anyway, anyone who's listening, ignore what we said about the detail go Google LOLA and what it actually says. But broadly speaking, it is all to do with lifting, even if I had some of the details wrong. So apologies for that.
Let's carry on and make some more mistakes.
Talking of making mistakes, did you get fooled by any April Fool spoofs in newspapers yesterday or anything?
No, I didn't notice any. Maybe that's just simply because I just wasn't aware of them. But no, I didn't see anything which is clearly a spoof.
You're never quite sure when you're reading things about the American president, what might be true and what might not be true. Yeah. But then no doubt he'd say the same thing, you know, the mainstream media and all that.
Plenty of fake news.
I didn't see anything in the newspapers that I looked at. However, I did receive a moderately amusing press release, which was clearly a spoof, embargoed for the 1st of April 2025.
Oh, right, okay.
From giveaway. The Transport Action Network, who are basically the anti-road building campaign group. Well, they don't mind buses on roads, but they don't like road building generally. And they sent out a piece sort of welcoming the rebranding of England's Strategic Roads organisation, having changed its name from Highways Agency to Highways England and then National Highways in the past few years. They've gone for a third rebrand, and in following the lead of the new railways organisation, Great British Rail, National Highways has been rebranded as Great British Highways, which all sounds quite plausible, until you realise that the Great British Highways is GBH, which is what this campaign group thinks of government road building policy as being GBH.
So, yeah, a bit too subtle, that one. That would have gone over my head. Well, the thing is, I mean, they're quite right. National Highways has changed its name so many times, you wouldn't bat an eyelid if you saw that it come out with a new name.
But talking about acronyms, I remember getting a press release from what, in the very olden days, I think it's the 1980s, this would have been from the Department for the Environment, saying they'd set up a construction research advisory panel. And
I looked at this. I can see where you're going with it.
And I rang him up and I said, is it actually called this? The Construction Research Advisory Panel, is that what it actually called? He went, yeah, what's wrong with that? I said, you sure? I said, yeah, it's a CRAP. Went, oh, hang on, we'll get back to you.
Dear, oh dear.
Okay. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, anyway, talking about government departments, there's a bit of government news around this over the last week or so.
We're talking politics again.
I'm afraid we're going to talk politics because the Chancellor of the Exchequer has been at it again. She said it wasn't a budget, didn't she? She said it was a spring statement. But I know a lot of people who don't approve of Rachel Reeves said it was her mini budget. But anyway, she said some quite important things.
But no, it wasn't. I understand it wasn't a budget, because a budget is where they set tax rate. In the olden days, they'd have an autumn budget where they talk about, they have a spring budget where they talk about, you know, tax on beer and fags and petrol and all of that.
Yeah.
And then an autumn statement saying, this is how we're going to spend the money. This is who's getting what. Yeah. And now they've flipped it. So this was, it was still a fiscal event, which said she's only going to do one a year. So the second fiscal event, but it was a statement on spending. And as far as the wider world is concerned, there are two things of interest. Mm. One is the welfare cuts, which are coming down the line, which are going to be bad news for a lot of people. And two is the latest forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility, which is saying that growth is going to be slower this year than expected. I'm not going to get into the details of that. But then we'll pick up again next year, I think, or the year after. But the particular, my takeaway from the announcement from the Chancellor last week, particular one, was the Office for OBR, Office for Budget Responsibility, produced their forecast on house building, new homes. Mm. And this is particularly significant or interesting and relevant because manifesto commitment from the Labour government was to have 1.5 million new homes built in England by the end of the parliament. March 2030 is the notionally, hypothetically, the last day of the parliament. But you can call the election before then. So that's what the target is. And what the OBR is saying, it's probably going to be less than 1.3 million, fewer than 1.3 million cumulative net additions. Now, there are two things here. They're talking about cumulative net additions. So if you knock down 100 houses and build 200, that's only 100 cumulative net additions, but you've built 200.
Right,
so
okay.
There are ways of playing with numbers, of course. But even that, I thought, was quite optimistic, given that we're, a year in and there haven't been that many in the first year. We're badly behind.
Yeah, we are, time. Yeah.
And the planning department's all chocked up and the planning reforms are coming down the line, and that if you in the house building business, that's all should become good news.
Mm-hmm.
But whether it will filter through in time to hit this 1.5 million in England by 2030 is doubtful, frankly.
Yeah.
And I tried to analyse it. What the OBR was talking about was 1.3 in the whole of the UK rather than just England. And I thought, how big a difference in terms of house building numbers, how big a difference is England to UK? Mm-hmm. And I was surprised that while we are building thousands upon thousands of houses and homes, flats and whatever, in England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales are, by comparison, peanuts. I mean, they're hundreds as opposed to our thousands, which I thought was quite interesting.
Is that simply because they haven't got the same sort of population growth in those areas?
I guess.
Or is it simply because they're not going to do what Westminster tells them to do?
I don't know. I don't think it's that. I think I'm guessing. Population plus money. Where do people want to, where are the jobs, where do people want to buy houses? And people want to, basically they want to live in London and move to the southeast where they can get to where the jobs are.
Hmm, interesting. I don't think it came as a surprise to many people that, it was unlikely that they were going to hit this 1.5 million homes by 2030 target. Because, people were saying almost as soon as Keir Starmer opened his mouth and said it in the first place, they said, well, that's never going to happen. I mean, we've got a chronic labour shortage, which is only getting worse. I mean, there's been no improvement on that. I think we're going to get onto that in a minute. And as you said, housing output has actually gone down, I think, hasn't it, since that announcement was made over the last year? I don't think it's picked up.
I've got a graph in front of me, but I can't quite see the dates. It certainly has been going down. I mean, from the last time it went up was just on the back of COVID. There was kind of like, quick, we had a lockdown, let's build some more.
Yeah.
Since 2023, it's been going down, 2024 going down. And now they're saying it's going to start going back up again.
I mean, the OBR, as you say, I mean, obviously it's being a little bit more cautious than the government. I mean, obviously it's saying you don't want to hit the target, so that, I suppose you could call that caution. But it tempers that by saying growing economies of scale and greater adoption of modular construction methods, I'm quoting here, incidentally, may enable sustained improvements in the sector's efficiency and its capacity to build houses, which is true, but it's unlikely. I mean, I don't know about growing economies of scale, but greater adoption of modular construction methods is one of those old chestnuts. Everybody sort of trots it out from time to time, but as we've seen in the last year or so, there hasn't been an increase in modular construction methods. There's been quite the reverse. You know, we've talked about Ilka Homes and people like that who simply haven't been able to cut the mustard, basically.
Well, they're obviously different categories of what they call MMC, which, as I've said before, annoys me. There's nothing particular modern about it. But and I can't remember which is one, which is two, which is three. But it varies from house on a box that arrives ready built on a trailer, which is a sort of ilky thing, to flat pack kit homes, to simply using
truss rafters and stuff like that.
Timber frames. And it's the latter category, I think, is growing, and people are investing in and increasing their use of timber-framed housing.
Yeah.
And in fact, in Scotland, I believe it's a norm, or at least, you know, more common than not.
Yes, yeah.
So you could argue that there's more modularity going on, but not of the Lego type.
No. And the other thing, of course, is lack of relevant skills. I mean, one of the big things about off-site manufacturing is that you don't need traditional skills. And to quote Rachel Reeves, brickies, sparkies and chippies, which sounds like a phrase she hardly ever produces. But anyway, she wrote in the Mail on Sunday about how she's going to train more brickies, sparkies and chippies. But off-site manufacturing doesn't require those skills. It's a manufacturing process and a lot of it's done by machine. But we need more of these trades, and that's something else which she was keen to put forward, wasn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of the good news, which is related to the spring statement, was trailed beforehand. It came out in the week and days before she actually stood up in Parliament. One of these was the allocation of £600 million to training skilled construction workers.
Mm.
Apparently, £600 million will train 60,000 people. So, quick math, it's quite expensive to train people, £10,000 per person to get them trained up. Hopefully, they'll pay their, in the macroeconomic sense, they'll pay for themselves quite quickly. And yes, another part of the government policy is to cut quangos and agencies and bureaucracies and everything. So in line with this policy, they've created another quango, the Construction Skills Mission Board, which sounds awfully like what the Construction Industry Training Board used to do, and more recently the Construction Leadership Council's working party on people and skills has been undertaking this sort of role. So we've already got CITB and the Construction Leadership Council doing stuff in this area.
Yeah.
Now we've got a third organisation, Construction Skills Mission Board, which is being chaired by construction industry's busiest man, Mark Reynolds. I don't quite know how he finds time to do this. Maybe he's been cloned. Maybe there are two of him.
He's the boss of Mace, by the way, isn't he? Just in case people don't recognise the name.
Yeah, but he's also the boss of Mace. He's also, I think he might still be the co-chair of the Construction Leadership Council. I think he's due to hand over to someone else shortly on that job. But yes, he runs Mace, and he heads up the Construction Leadership Council. So he's gunning hard for the knighthood, is what I reckon.
Oh, let's face it, he's earned it. But it also is very complicated. I mean, if this is an attempt to try and streamline things and you know, push forward, I don't know, sort of turbo boost construction skills training, I don't think it doesn't sound as if it's making it easier. There are so many organisations and initiatives and stuff like this, all of which seem to be ploughing their own furrow in a bid to try and push through more training and recruitment, you know, skills boot camps and local skills improvement plans. I mean, I'd never even encountered those before. This is all in this. These are just phrases which I pulled out of your news report, Phil. LSIPs, local skills improvement plans, entrance support teams, NESTs programs, and you know, then there's, as you say, there's a CITB, which you know, Construction Industry Training Board, which is supposed to be basically the organisation that is responsible for training people in construction skills. I don't know why they can't leave them. Well, we know why they can't leave them to do it, because I mean, it's just a shadow of its former self.
But apparently, one of the log jams, one of the hindrances of training people. Is I was reading something that the House Builders Federation put out, or it might have been National Federation of Builders, put out yesterday, the day before, and then quickly withdrew. And I think they're a bit worried that they're being a bit intemperate, even though they said everything they said was accurate. If you want to put up a training yard in your, if you've got a big house building site and you want to allocate a little corner to trainees, so you can, you know, practice laying bricks before you let them loose on the actual real houses. Mm-hmm. And quite a lot of people do this, apparently, but you have to get specific planning permission for that element of the site. So you've got planning permission for the building site and say, yeah, over there we're going to have a little training corner. And local council is saying, yeah, but how much traffic is that going to generate? You're going to have a bike rack there? You're going to, you know, how, and it can take months. You know, after you started work, you think, oh, we need more people. We'll get, you know, we'll have a little training centre, you know, mini training centre on this site. And it can take months to get that through the local authority.
Right, it's just ridiculously bureaucratic.
Yes, yeah, exactly that. I think you just ought to be taken as read that if you've got a building site, you're allowed to have a training, you know, yeah, a training area without massive conditions tied to it.
I mean, I visited a site not that long ago. I mean, I say not that long ago. It was a few years ago, but not in the, you know, back in the dark ages, quite a big site down near Exeter, where they had put aside a little corner of part of the site compound and were keeping chickens there. So they had their own eggs.
How lovely.
Yeah, I thought that was great, actually. I don't know if they got planning permission for that, but I very much doubt it.
Do you need planning permission for chickens?
No, I don't know, but do you need planning permission to train a few brickies?
I don't know the details, though. I know one of the things was about, you know, traffic impact, and they don't want lots more people driving to site than are already doing it.
Well, presumably they're only going to be training people to work on that particular site, weren't they?
Yeah.
I can't see the point of training people on one site and then telling them to go off and work on another one. But anyway, it's, yeah, it does sound a bit stupid.
But anyway, we have, I mean, however you cut it, £600 million going into training. And, I mean, okay, it's another training-related organisation being set up. I mean, I'm not keen on the, I don't know how much money it's going to cost to run the Construction Skills Mission Board. And I'm not keen on more organisations to make the ones we've got work properly.
Yeah, exactly.
But the money going into training is clearly a good thing and badly needed. So, you know, credit there.
Yeah.
One of the other sort of pre-spring statement bits of good news that came out was one of your favourite subjects, solar panels. £200 million programme of fitting solar panels to schools and hospitals in England.
Well, I'm fully in favour of that. I think it's a good idea.
Well, you like them on buildings, don't you?
I like them on buildings. I think they should be on buildings, but particularly public sector buildings and, you know, things like schools, hospitals, factories, car parks, that kind of thing. I think it's excellent idea. I'm not so keen on them on greenfield sites.
So you won't be happy with multiplex then?
I'm tempted to call it greenwashing. They would probably be extremely angry to hear me call it greenwashing, because I'm sure that their intentions are entirely honourable. Yeah, but Multiplex, a contractor, they've just plugged in a new, I can't remember, is it 10 megawatt solar panel, solar farm somewhere in Norfolk? I can't remember exactly how it is. I've got it somewhere. And it was, the Northwold Solar PV Generating Station somewhere in Norfolk, but I don't know what its capacity is. But they say they developed it in partnership with this organisation that does solar farms with one of those names which I can't really pronounce. I'm trying to remember what it is. Here we are. Ampyr. A-M-P-Y-R. Yeah, so Multiplex, they've got their own solar PV farm. So they're now entirely self-sufficient in electricity. Well, they don't say that. But what they do say is that they are the first contractor to have their own solar farm. And they're using it to power, I think, three quite major sites in London, aren't they?
Yeah,
directly, of course.
You mentioned greenwashing. I'm going to stand up for this because I think it's one thing. I mean, yeah, this solar farm that they've built in Norfolk is not going to be powering multiplex sites. It's going to be powering local houses and businesses in the area.
You'll feed into the grid.
Yeah. Now, what we've railed against before is the whole concept of offsetting. And if you say, our site in London, because we're going to use this much electricity or, you know, diesel or whatever, we're going to chuck a few bob at some, you know, trees in it somewhere else or whatever. That whole offsetting thing, I'm not particularly interested by. I'm not saying I'm not keen on it. It's better to do it than not do it, but it's all a bit bogus. Whereas I think Multiplex have gone further. It's not some notional solar farm. It is actually their own.
Yes, that's true. They've developed it.
They're offsetting what they're doing with their left hand against what they're doing with their right hand. So it's internal offsetting, if you like, which is much more acceptable and possibly completely acceptable, I would.
Yeah, argue. I mean, after all, it all goes into the grid, doesn't it? However you generate your energy, it has to go into the grid and, you know, the national grid. I don't know how they do it, but they have to balance supply and demand. So, you know, times of peak demand, you know, like during the advertising break in Coronation Street, you know, everybody puts a kettle on. You know, then they need to up the amount of energy coming into the network. So I suppose you could say it all goes into the network. It all gets mixed up, you know, the green energy and the horrible dirty energy. So, and then you take what you need out of the grid, but then Multiplex can say, well, we've taken this amount out for these three sites, but we've put in the same amount of green energy. So
carbon neutral.
I think the logic is a bit more compelling than just going out and saying, well, we've planted a few trees somewhere or, you know, whatever.
Absolutely. So are you going to take back your greenwashing comment?
No, I'm not. I will take it back. So apologies to Multiplex. I'm sure that they're doing the right thing. But I do have a bee in my bonnet about solar power, as you rightly say, and only because there are some schemes locally to me which have, you know, definitely is an agricultural economy. Well, no, it's tourism. That's the main part of the economy. But you know, there's a lot of agricultural land around here, and people are putting solar panels on. And the thing which really got my goat recently was that there's a big 80 megawatt solar farm planned for a greenfield site on agricultural land near Great Torrington in the Torridge district of North Devon. And I can't even remember who the developer is, so I'm not going to mention them. But they've put in this application for a 28 megawatt a solar farm, a place called Deptford Farm near Torrington, and it goes against the local plan. Clearly goes against the local plan. There's an awful lot of local objection to it. People don't want it, and the planning inspector got involved, and he said, and I'm quoting here, it introduces uncharacteristic industrial-esque development over a relatively large area. And he added that it would harm the character and appearance of the surrounding landscape. And he pointed out that it goes against the North Devon and Torridge local plan. But he said, I'm still going to give it the go-ahead because of significant benefits which outweigh the landscape harm. I mean, I think the benefits are that it'll provide enough energy for 8,000 homes, and I just think it's nonsense.
You know, it's going. Build, baby, build.
Well, I know, but it's that absolute idiot, Ed Miliband, who has this, who seems to think that the UK is like the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dike, and that we, you know, we can single-handedly hold back the tide of climate change and global warming, while China and Russia and India and America, you know, continue to pump out, you know, carbon emissions. And, you know, the thing is, if Ed Miliband can't see what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic and acknowledge the futility of what he's trying to do, then, you know, we're on a downward spiral. That's my view anyway. You know, these solar farms, put them on roofs, put them on schools and hospitals, great, you know, and they all go into the mix and they reduce our carbon emissions. That's all great. And we can pat ourselves on the back, but we're not going to make any difference by, you know, plastering these things all over the countryside. And after all, most of these solar panels will probably come from China anyway.
I think the Labour government, no, they don't have many votes in the countryside, and they don't have many country, you know, country folk on their benches. So there's not a huge, I mean, it's an urban organisation, the Labour government. It's focused on that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I always reach for my revolver when I hear the term solar power.
Well, there was another pre-spring statement announcement of huge interest to the construction industry, which was hugely welcome over. This is fantastic news. At last, it's going ahead. It's happening. The Lower Thames Crossing.
Oh, yeah.
The Transport Secretary, whoever it is this week, it's not Louise Hague anymore, is it?
It isn't.
It's the woman who used to do a Deputy Mayor of London for Transport. Forgive me, I've forgotten her name. But she signed the development consent order for the Lower Thames Crossing, this 9, 10, 13, 15 billion pound project. Take your pick. I'd go at the higher end of that by the time construction actually starts. And it was like, fantastic. And all the headlines go, this project's now going ahead. It's cleared for takeoff. Green light for the Lower Thames Crossing. But when the Chancellor actually stood up and made a spring statement, I think it's kind of an expectation saying, right, we've now signed the development consent order. This is what we're going to do. Well, she said in a budget statement last November that she was looking into exploring, she commissioned studies into privately financing it or partly private financing it, which is like, oh, you know, long grass time. And so the fact that the development consent order is the Department for Transport dragging it out of the long grass and trying to keep it moving. But as far as the Treasury is concerned, it ain't happening yet. It's not happening because the government don't have £10 billion to spend on this project. So all these people saying, great, it's going ahead, at the moment deluded.
Yeah.
National Highways say that they've got, what's the quote? They've set out a number of viable funding options for the project, which they've already submitted to the Treasury, and they expect a final decision from the Treasury on which of these models is taken forward to be made shortly. I replied to the Department of Transport press office, shortly, you sound like a parent. And the response came, indeed I am.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's all very well to say that, yes, it can go ahead, but if the money isn't there, then clearly nothing's going to happen. But you're a big enthusiast for the private finance model in this particular case, aren't you, Phil?
Well, I'm not. I'd much rather we got it for free, but that ain't going to happen. But it does lend itself. PFI is ostensibly dead. The Tory government said, when anything financially said, it's not the government really saying, it's the Treasury. I mean, you'll notice that what Rachel Reeves is doing and saying is no different from what George Osborne was doing. It's the Treasury.
Yeah.
And the only time things differ from the, or go off piece from the Treasury is when you've got, you know, lunatics in charge of the asylum and do what they want regardless of what the Treasury officials are telling them to do, and then they crash the economy. So the Treasury orthodoxy, you know, has been that, oh, we can't do PFI anymore because we realise it's rubbish value for money. But that's only in the case, as I mentioned before, and I don't want to rehearse the arguments again, where there's no genuine revenue stream coming from the user. In this case, parcel the Lower Thames Crossing with the existing Dartford crossings into a single business entity, corporate entity, you've got a viable business and
an income stream.
It has a steady toll income stream. It can go ahead. To put that into place would take years and delay it. And as I said before, it's, to my mind, the quick solution is for the contractors who've already been, they haven't been awarded, they haven't signed the contracts because there's no work to be done yet because the Treasury haven't said there's no money there. But the contractors who've been picked and anointed by the National Highways, I think they need to grab the thistle and move it forward. I don't think they're going to, though. I think National Highways hope that they can do it. It's a bit like the fudge of Euston Station HS2 business. They're saying it's basically a public sector project, but there's some developers in the area. Let's tap up the developers and see if we get some money out of them. I don't think it's going to be hugely significant. And then I think the Treasury are going to go, yeah, okay, well, we'll go ahead on this basis when we can afford it, and it'll get kicked back into the long grass. So I don't think the future is quite as bright for the Lower Thames Crossing as everyone seemed to think when the development consent order got signed.
So it's a case of don't watch this space then, Phil.
I fear so. I mean, it's another one of those projects that's been in planning for ever and a day. They spent, reported figures have been 1.3 billion. The figure the government admits to is 800 million has been spent on the planning so far. So somewhere between that, either way, it's the best part of £1 billion have been spent, and we haven't even built anything for it, so it's ridiculous. However, all of this problems with planning infrastructure is going to be a thing of a past, because we've got a new Quango, I don't know if it's Quango, a new agency, a new organisation has been created. It came into being on the 1st of April, and this wasn't a Fool's Day spoof. This was genuine and real. Also a Labour manifesto commitment. They're scrapping the National Infrastructure Commission, and they're scrapping, which is part of the who's that? A Cabinet Office. The National Infrastructure Commission, the panel of experts that reports to the Cabinet Office, and the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, which is a Treasury body. They're both being scrapped and merged into a new body called the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority, NISTA. And again, forgive me if we talked about this before, but I think I said at the time that abolishing the National Infrastructure Commission, they're only going to have to reinvent it, because they all want to depoliticise politics and get all the difficult decisions taken by, you know, a consensus of experts, which is why the National Infrastructure Commission was first set up. To basically outsource decision making or outsource needs assessment, I should say, and provide cover. It's very analogous to the Climate Change Committee. And the Climate Change Committee say, ban boilers, go for heat pumps. Government say, oh, we've got to ban boilers, go for heat pumps, because that's what the Climate Change Committee, it's not us, that's what they say. And they're the experts, they know best. And rather like the National Infrastructure Commission say, we need more nuclear power stations, which the government can say, well, we've got to do it, that's what they say, they're the experts. And this is meant to take the politics out of planning, take the politics out of infrastructure. Yeah, okay. and bugger me, if slipped in the footnotes of the setting up of the National Infrastructure and Service Transformation Authority as a body within within the Treasury, and I'll come on to why that's relevant in a minute, that they're also setting up an advisory panel for NISTA.
Bloody hell.
The NISTA Advisory Council. And it doesn't just sound like the National Infrastructure Commission. The people are going to be the same people who are on the National Infrastructure Commission. So effectively, the National Infrastructure Commission is not being scrapped. It's having a new name called the NISTA Advisory Council. Now, what is happening that's different is that NISTA is not going to be in the Cabinet Office like the Infrastructure and Projects, the IPA, was in the Cabinet Office. NISTA is going to be in the Treasury. And also in the footnotes, it said the Treasury and the Cabinet Office are working on a memorandum of understanding that they hope to sign soon on exactly what the relationship is between NISTA and the Treasury and the Cabinet Office. In other words, the Cabinet Office is saying, well, you've taken the IPA office and you've subsumed it into the Treasury. to sit alongside its advisory council, i.e. what used to be the National Infrastructure Commission. Where do we fit into this? Enough. Treasury-based.
You don't. Yeah, exactly.
That's what it aims at. So there's clearly a power struggle going on there. And it does make sense to make two organisations one, but they're not. They're still quite rightly and sensibly having the panel of experts sitting alongside them like they did before.
So is it just window dressing then? I mean, is it just making it look different? Or is there any...
No, I mean, where's the quote? NISTA will get a grip on the delays to infrastructure delivery that for far too long plagued our global reputation with investors, says Darren Jones, Chief Secretary of the Treasury. We are ushering in a new era for infrastructure delivery, restoring the confidence of businesses to invest and driving a decade of national renewal, powering growth across the country and delivering on our plan of change.
Definitely overselling
it. So no, David, it's not just window dressing. Of course not.
I suppose he would say that. But no, it's over-egging the cake there, I reckon.
And it's got no chief executive. The person who's looking after NISTA for the time being is some bloke who used to be private secretary to Prince William.
Great. What happened to John Armitt, by the way? He's still sort of hanging around in the wings, isn't he? Until
No. He announced before Christmas, I think, back in the last year, that he would be retiring. I mean, he's supposed to retire a couple of years ago and said, all right, hang on, I'll do another half.
Because he was in charge of the National Infrastructure Commission, wasn't he?
He was chair of the National Infrastructure Commission, but he said that when they do this new setup, he'll stand down. He's in his 80s now. So, I mean, he deserves the rest.
Okay. Well, again, I don't think we're going to see much come out of that for the time being.
The other thing we don't have yet, even though we've got this new transformation authority, NISTA, we don't have a national infrastructure strategy. The last one was written in 2020, I beg your pardon, which is basically, it's informed by what the National Infrastructure Commission produced, their sort of needs assessment, basically. And then I think it's the IPA, actually write the strategy. And it's renewed. And it's great because what you do is you write down what we're going to build, like a high-speed railway line to Leeds and a high-speed railway line to Manchester. And then that can't be changed because it's set down in stone. Yeah. So that's why we need a strategy, so we can absolutely say it's set down in stone and politicians can't tinker with it. So that's good. We'll get that soon, apparently. The 2025 edition of the National Infrastructure will happen soon. And no doubt it will have projects in it which will then be cancelled and or delayed.
Right. I think that's enough politics. There's quite an interesting timber story. Well, I say it's interesting.
You like your materials.
I say it's an interesting timber story. Actually, I don't think it's all that significant, although I think the timber development trade body, Timber Development UK, would argue that this is very important.
Well, no, they're actually saying it's not very important. Don't worry. They think it's important, but it's not.
Well, that's, okay, then fine. But they would probably take issue with me saying that timber isn't important. I certainly don't mean that. No, it's, when you're building a stud wall or something like that, you usually use white wood. I think it's European white wood, it's normally marketed as. I think it used to be called deal or spruce, depending on what you're doing. But anyway, it's those sort of conifers that grow up in sort of Scandinavia. That's where we get our timber stud work from. And it's all this sort of European spruce. But there have been problems with European sawmills, and I'm not actually sure what problems there have been with European sawmills. I mean, I don't think the trees have stopped growing. Maybe they've had difficulty harvesting them. I don't know. But anyway, there is a bit of a shortage of this white wood now,
I can tell you what the Timber UK, Timber Development UK say. It's down to bark beetle infestations.
Oh, is it?
Geopolitical factors. Uh-huh.
Okay, I understand that.
Probably means Putin.
Yeah.
And changing forest management priorities.
Right, okay.
I don't know what would be behind that, but I would imagine changing forest management priorities is a result of geopolitical factors.
I think I know a little bit about this, but I'm probably very out of date. I think we get a lot of our wood from obviously Scandinavia, but actually I think quite a lot of it comes or has historically come from Russia as well.
Ukraine exported wood and wood products at more than $2 billion by value in 2021.
Ah, okay.
So Ukraine gets
Okay. Now I wouldn't have said Ukraine. When I think of Ukraine, I think of grain rather than timber. I would have thought that because Russia being further north would have, you know, had all those plantations up in the tundra there. But anyway, yeah, I see what you mean by the geopolitical influences.
Russia, Belarus. Sorry, I'm reading now. Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine accounted for nearly 25% of worldwide lumber trade.
Oh, really?
In 2021.
Wow. Okay. Right. Well, that.
So that's 25% of world trade affected by Russia, Ukraine. Yeah. That's going to have a big impact.
And when you consider that, you know, basically is the go-to softwood for all your carcassing and stud work in the UK, then any shortage, I suppose, of that is going to be problematic. But they say don't worry because you can use redwood instead, which is European redwood, aka pine. And I suppose it's maybe because the bark beetle doesn't affect the pine. I don't know. But you can use pine instead of spruce, and it's perfectly good stuff. And in fact, I can't say that I used an awful lot of either. But there's nothing wrong with pine; it's not perfectly nice wood to work with.
It sounds like judging by the note that the Timber Development UK put out last week, was basically saying, don't worry, folks, if your timber merchant is trying to sell you pine instead of spruce, redwood instead of whitewood, that's absolutely fine. He's not trying to con you or make a fast buck or anything. Spruce is hard to get hold of because everything's going on. You know, pine is being imported in greater numbers instead, and it's got exactly the same performance characteristics. Yeah. Pine is more readily able to absorb preservative treatments. Mm-hmm. So it's even better for garden and exterior products such as decking and cladding.
I think it's better. I mean, to work with from the my very limited experience. I used to have a small holding up near Exmoor, and my neighbour, a farmer, used to have regular deliveries of very peculiar packing cases because they were 12 feet long, and in cross section they were 6 inches by 6 inches. So you would get 4 planks out of these packing cases, 2 6-inch wide planks and 2 4-inch wide planks. All the planks were 1 inch thick, and they were redwood. They were European pine. I don't know what was delivered in them, but I had loads and loads of these things, and I replaced several floors in my house using this stuff.
You built your house in packing cases?
I didn't build it.
T-chest the furniture.
I had rotten floorboards, so I replaced them with some of these boards, and they're really nice stuff to work with, actually. So I can vouch for European redwood. It's perfectly good stuff. So I don't think there's any problem with it. Maybe slightly more resinous than the spruce, but doesn't really matter, I suppose. Yeah. So I'm surprised actually that they've had to put out this notice saying that, you know, it's perfectly all right to use pine instead of spruce, because I think a lot of people probably think spruce is pine.
I'm not sure I'd know the difference, but you know how traditional the construction industry is. If it sees any sort of change, it goes, ooh, ooh.
Yeah, that's true.
What's happening here then?
Yeah.
And am I being diddled?
I don't know. Maybe pine's a bit knottier. I don't know. Anyway.
Anything else we need to talk about, David?
Nothing on my list. I can't think of anything else that's cropped up that we ought to discuss, really. I think we've done a pretty good job of summarising last fortnight's news.
Quick mention of Bovis. Lendlease has sold.
Oh, yes.
Lendlease has sold its European business. I mean, it was announced last year that it had put it up for sale, Lendlease being an Australian company.
Mm-hmm.
And it was bought by an American private equity firm. That was announced in January. And this week that deal has closed, gone through. And Lendlease Europe is now Bovis. Being back the old original name, which I had to sort of stop and think, well, hang on a minute, Bovis Homes, okay, they're not called Bovis Homes anymore, it's now Vistry, but Vistry still uses the Bovis brand. Is there not an ownership issue? But Bovis Lendlease operated simultaneously with Bovis Homes, using both using the Bovis brand, yet completely separate legal entities, and had been for a couple of decades or so.
Did they use the same logo as well?
No.
I mean, that hummingbird logo.
That's just for Bovis Homes.
And
that belongs to Vistry, the hummingbird logo.
Right. Okay.
I am reminded of someone I used to know who was a college lecturer, and he was asking me about any sort of business case studies that I could suggest to him to use an example in his lectures. And I was telling him about something that Bovis had done recently, and he said, "Oh, that sounds really interesting." This is back in the 80s or 90s or something. He said, "Oh,
yeah,
that sounds really interesting." And he said, "Okay, I'll use that." And he mentioned it in his lecture. And the only trouble is between me talking to him and him getting to his lecture class a week later, he'd forgotten the precise details of the name of the company. And at the end of the year, when he got the exam papers back from the students, everyone had written about this building company called Hovis. And he thought, "Why? What's going on here?" And he thought, "Oh, did I use the wrong name?"
Oh, no. Oh, my God. Well, back in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, I briefly played bass in a new wave band.
You never?
I did,
What were they called?
God, I can't remember what we called ourselves. Oh, the Boondocks. We called ourselves the Boondocks.
Excellent.
And our lead guitarist and frontman.
I've got to keep interrupting. What did you wear?
I just wore jeans and a t-shirt.
New wave.
I was very unimaginative. I'm afraid. I didn't have sugar in my hair or safety pins in my nose or anything like that. It wasn't proper punk. And I think we only played one gig, which wasn't very successful. But anyway, our frontman Simon, actually, his stage name was Bovis Cortina.
Yeah, I like that.
Which was, I thought, was quite good. Tripped off the tongue.
What was yours? Yeah.
I did have one. I just stood at the back playing the bass.
I'm impressed.
You wouldn't be impressed if you heard any of our demo tapes.
Do they still exist?
No.
Not too late, you know.
I say that, actually. I've got a mystery cassette here. I don't know what's on it.
Folks, David is holding up a TDK C90. I haven't seen one of those for about 15
That's
years.
That's true, yeah. Yeah. So, no, yeah, I've still got that. I do mean to find myself a cassette deck and put it on and find out what's on it. But I don't think it's a Boondocks.
It might be cheaper to buy yourself an old car than to buy...
Yeah, probably. Yeah, exactly. All right.
Right, I think we're done. Thank you, people, for joining us again. But for another episode of Reconstruction, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.